Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Funny how that works. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we are here live broadcasting from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn at Heritage Radio Network. And we're talking about taste, not just taste really, but about the larger idea of the importance of good taste and of flavor and of food in general, one of the true pleasures of life. And with me today is someone who helps bring a lot of pleasure to many people's lives, Allison Cave, who is the founder and CBO, I'll call you, the Chief Baking Officer of First Prize Pies. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we are here to talk about almost everyone's favorite topic, the pie, but a little bit larger than the context of just how you make a pie, but really what it's all about and what our love for pies is. I'll remind our listeners that you can call in with questions about pie, about taste, about Allison, about maybe starting your own business, which we'll get into. Also, by dialing 718-497-2128. You can call in. I should recognize that it's highlighted for me and everything, but I read the wrong one. Again, the call-in number is 718-497-2128, or you can write in questions at info@heritageradionetwork.com. Allison, tell us, how is it that you come to be a pie maker?
It was very much happenstance, I have to say. It sort of just all fell in my lap, and it was never a long-term goal. I mean, I'm happy I'm here.
Right.
But it was...
You weren't a young girl beside your mother making rolling out dough thinking one day I'm going to have a pie company.
No, not really. I mean, I definitely was a young girl beside my mother, you know, baking and cooking and rolling out dough, but I never really thought it was going to be a career. And my first career was actually in the art world, and I worked in galleries for a long time and curated, and that's sort of my background. Mm-hmm. But my whole family pretty much works in food. And so food has always been sort of the thing that we talk about whenever we get together. It's always been kind of the topic of conversation at all times and sort of the glue, I think, that kind of holds us all together in some way. And so even though I was working in the art world, it seemed like every waking minute I spent outside of my job, I was talking about or making or thinking about food.
We appreciate that. Those of us who do the same.
Right.
And we have done so together before you had a pie company. So
yeah.
Then what happened? How did the pie business fall in your lap?
Basically, I always loved baking pie. It's always been sort of like my thing in the family. And every Thanksgiving, I would, you know, play around with a new recipe. And a couple of years ago, I got an email from my boyfriend, Jay, with a link to the first annual Brooklyn Pie Bake Off. Mm-hmm. And it just said, you should enter this, you will win. and I love his faith in you. But, you know, I certainly never really went into it thinking, I'm going to win this. I was not like hyper competitive in any way about it. But I thought it sounded really fun. And so I entered with two pies. One was the bourbon ginger pecan, which I've been making every year for years and years. It's been a recipe that I've developed over maybe 10 years.
Sounds very Thanksgiving.
Yeah, exactly. And I would make it for Thanksgiving every year for my family. And then the other was the s'mores pie, which I kind of just winged and had never made before. Mm-hmm. And you had to have a local ingredient. So for that, I used the Mass Brothers chocolate, which I love to eat, but it was really rich for a s'mores pie. And I make it totally differently now.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was just too dark, really.
So you entered this contest. What year are we?
This was 2009.
And?
And I won with the bourbon ginger pecan. And it was just a really fun day. You know, it was like, I won the best overall prize. Jay actually wound up entering as well. He just got really into the whole spirit of the thing and entered with an apple cider cream pie, which is delicious. And he won best sweet pie. So it was family affair.
You sweeped the pie.
We did.
Contest,
it was crazy. Right. And it was funny because the organizers didn't realize we were a couple. And later there was a photographer her taking pictures, and we were, you know, standing next to each other with our arms around each other, holding our little prize bags, and they were like, "Do you guys know each other? Like, why are you getting so close?"
No, we just met. Love over pie. Exactly. Love over winning pies, right?
Yeah, I think that I think it was the Greenpoint Gazette published something, and they called us the Brooklyn Pie Power Couple.
Which then proved to be more prescient than perhaps you even knew at the time.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it was kind of this, you know, really auspicious start to this thing that I didn't see coming, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just wanted to kind of keep the feeling going because there was so much kind of fun community that was generated around mm-hmm. that day. I mean, not just, you know, with my friends and family coming out, but there were so many people there, and it was such a fun thing, and just seeing this huge table full of pies was something really special. And so I enjoyed having this creative outlet and kind of sharing it with people. Mm-hmm. So I started selling pies by the slice on Saturdays at my mom's chocolate shop, which is Ronnie Sue's Chocolates in the Essex Street Market.
Okay.
And, you know, it was like started to take off. People started to kind of, you know that there was going to be pie there on Saturdays, and it became more of a thing. And I was like, well, maybe I should just start this as like a little side business. I mean, at the time I was working for an artist in his studio, and it was a pretty kind of golden handcuffs kind of job. Like, it was, you know, a good salary and very stable, but it was very sort of easy for mm-hmm. me, and it wasn't very challenging. And so it was nice to have something else outside of that.
Sure.
So as soon as I gave it a name, really, and I registered my LLC and I set up my website, I got a write-up in Daily Candy, and that just kind of blew the
Suddenly,
whole thing up.
Right.
It was crazy.
Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, people really will do whatever Deli Candy tells them to do.
So messages to people at home, if you're interested in starting something, get Daily Candy involved.
Yeah, I had no, I mean, I knew, they warned me that I would get a lot of attention from the article, but I really was not prepared for the number of orders that I got.
Well, that actually brings up a topic that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and we are in such an amazing artisanal food moment right now. I mean, we happen to be sitting in Brooklyn, which is ground central sort of for some of that in the New York area, but other cities and other places around the country have these little incubating neighborhoods. And I've often thought that part of what makes that moment possible today is technology, is the new way that we learn about things and get information. And Daily Candy is a perfect example, because all of these niches, which could only exist in places where rents aren't huge, where the New York Times might not go, all this sort of stuff, have a life beyond that. I mean, does that affect your business beyond the Daily Candy piece?
Hugely. I mean, I think that every time, I mean, I see the material signs every single time I get a write-up somewhere, and it doesn't have to be print. I mean, you know, I get a blog post written about me or, you know, anything. I see the impact. I get orders or I get inquiries, and, you know, also press leads to more press. So,
right.
You know, that Daily Candy article then led to so many other people writing things about me, because it was like, oh, you know, everyone wants to get on the hot new thing, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, that you see one thing and it leads to 10 more, and it's this sort of, you know, kind
snowball
of snowball effect. Exactly.
So do you engage? I mean, do you tweet?
I do. I try. I don't tweet as much as I probably should.
Because you're baking pies.
Because it's actually really, I have to say that, like, it's just physically difficult. I'm covered in flour a lot of the time.
What's your Twitter handle?
It's First Prize Pies, all spelled out. Yeah.
Okay. So, and you have a website, I'm sure.
I do. It's firstprizepies.com. And then I'm also on Facebook. It's just facebook.com/firstprizepies. Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, let's go back to pie. Well, let's talk about how the business evolved. So then suddenly you're making more pies. You have the good fortune of having a family in the food business. Talk about that a little bit, about your mom, Ronnie Sue, and your brother also.
Yeah, I mean, that actually had also a huge impact, I think, on my business, because it makes for a really kind of charming story, I
right,
think. And
right.
a lot of reporters enjoyed kind of digging into that a little bit. So my mom, Rhonda Cave, has a shop called Ronnie Sue's Chocolates in the Essex Street Market. And that's actually where I bake as well. So it's kind of really fun, because it became this like family business, you know.
But she also kind of fell into it.
She did. We have a similar story. It's just kind of separated by a couple of generations. But she, for years, I mean, when I was growing up, she was a stay-at-home mom for a long time. And chocolate was sort of her, again, like her hobby. She and a neighbor of ours started learning how to make chocolates in just some continuing ed classes. And every year they would make them as holiday gifts for friends and family and colleagues. And over the years, the list of people who were getting these chocolates grew longer and longer, and the variety of chocolates they were making became more and more complex and diverse. And eventually, she realized a few years ago that she wound up, like, I think, giving away something like 200 pounds of chocolate for free. Gosh. I mean, it was something crazy. Right. Like, she just sent out so much chocolate, and she was like, wow, I guess I could actually probably do this as a business,
right?
But it was a while before that happened. She was working as a social worker at the Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and she was getting her bachelor's at NYU. Mm. And for her thesis, she was writing about New York City markets. And so that led her for the first time to the Essex Street Market. And it was, again, sort of the serendipitous thing where she went in, she noticed this unused storage closet.
Really?
That was just, like, you know, papered over, that had pretty much nothing in it. Incredibly small space. And realized, like, I could do this. I could make this into something. And she did. She, you know, petitioned the market to transform that space into a shop. And that was her first location. She's now in a bigger space in the market.
Well, and the market has undergone a bit of a transformation, hasn't it?
It has. Yeah, it's definitely become, I think, a lot more of a destination. I mean, Heritage Meats is in there now, which, you right. know, we're all a fan.
Right, and we are sitting in the bounty of Heritage Meats here at Heritage Radio Network.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's Brooklyn Taco. There's a really great woman making Greek food called Boo Boo Key. There's a Japanese grocer in there now. My mom shops, Axel B. Cheesemonger, Shopsins, wow. Pain d'Avignon, amazing bread.
So, and that's a short time that went from a kind of seedy, maybe this, I mean, you could sense the potential when you walked through that market, even though it might not have been realized. And now it's this dynamic food.
Yeah,
thing.
It's really coming together. I think there's a lot more they can still do. Right. But the one thing I really love about it is that while they've added a lot of new vendors, all of those new vendors haven't pushed the old vendors out. So you've got, you know, still the Latin grocers who are selling, you know, peppers and stuff that you don't find anywhere else. And you still have all the, like, abuelitas with their carts coming in every morning and buying that day's groceries. And I really think that's what makes the market special and different from a place like Chelsea Market or one of these other more kind of upscale gentrified spaces. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really reflective of the neighborhood, I think, because you've got these older communities who've lived there for a really long time, and then you have these younger, you know, people coming in who are more, you know, maybe, I don't know, they have a different approach to food, and it's definitely a little bit more upscale or oats, mm-hmm. but they're existing side by side, and they're actually complementing each other.
And is there crossover in the clientele and people, I mean, interest from both communities and the other?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've noticed that, I mean, there's two butchers in the market, so there's Heritage Meats, and there's also Luis, who's been there for a long time, and I see people, and Heritage Meats actually is in the space where Jeffrey's was for a long time. And Jeffrey's family had had that space for decades and decades, I think since the 40s. Wow. It had been a very long-standing family business that unfortunately just didn't make it through. I think the economic downturn really affected mm-hmm. him. There are a lot of people who used to shop at Jeffrey's who are now shopping at Heritage. Amazing. And it is a different product, and it is a different price point and all of that. But I think that people are interested to learn, you know, about kind of what makes this meat different and where is it coming from and how does that affect, you know, my health and the health of my family. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of back and forth, and you see chefs coming in and buying meat at Heritage and then buying, you know, peppers at Viva. And, you know, it's like, I think that it's an interesting destination for food. It's a little different than anywhere else.
It's great. What role do you think the artisan has? We've heard chefs have become such huge celebrities in the last couple of decades. I mean, the last decade in particular, due in part to food TV and stuff like that. And bakers have sort of had their moment in competition food shows. But lately, you hear more and more about the chocolate artisan. I mean, the craft brewer, the pie maker. I mean, do you think there's What do you think they contribute to this larger conversation about food and an interest in food culture?
I think that there's an appeal to the idea of someone who does one thing really well, mm-hmm. you know, that you invest so much time and thought and practice into making this one thing as well as you possibly can, as mm-hmm. opposed to being sort of the jack of all trades or someone who, you know, can whip up anything at any time. I mean, you know, I've obsessed over pie crust. I've obsessed over recipes.
Thank
for,
goodness.
You know, And, you know, and it's like ever evolving. I'm always still trying something new. If I hear something, I'm trying it, you know? And so I think that people respond to that. I think that it shows a real kind of dedication and love for this sure. one thing. And it's also in a way like a slower approach, mm-hmm. I guess, you know, depending on what you're making, but I mean, you can't rush a pie.
Right.
Like it takes as long as it takes, you know, you have to let the dough rest. You have to, you know, let it bake for an hour. I mean, it's a time consuming process. And I think that, in this world where everything is faster and we get information really quickly and we move around a lot more quickly and just everything happens in a much faster way, there's something about slowing things down and someone who does that for a living that right. is unusual, maybe.
And appealing. So talking about slowing things down, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back just after this musical interlude.
Shoe fly pie, an apple pan, Dottie makes your eyes light up. Your tummy say howdy, shoe fly pie, an apple pan, Dottie, I never get enough of that wonderful stuff. Shoe fly pie, an apple pan, Dottie makes the sun come out when heavens are cloudy. Shoe fly pie, an apple pan, Dottie, I never get enough of that wonderful stuff. Mama, when you bake, Mama, I don't want cake, Mama, for my sake. Go to the oven and make some ever-loving shoo-shoo fly pie, an apple pan, Daddy makes your eyes light up. Your tummy say howdy, shoo fly pie, an apple pan, Daddy, I never get enough of that wonderful stuff.
Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we love to tell their stories. Simply Grazin Organic Farm, a family-owned operation, provides some of the highest standards in animal welfare around. Their 100% grass-fed beef comes from cows grazing outdoors with very little interference from the husband and wife team behind them. Come have a taste in one of our 6 Manhattan locations.
So we're back with Allison Cave, the founder and chief baking officer of First Prize Pies, and we're talking about our taste for pie. You can ask us questions by calling into 718-497-2128 or writing us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. So Dinah Shore was just singing about shoe fly pie and how nothing else satisfies like a good pie. And one of my questions to you is like, what is it about pie? You sort of got into it earlier before the break, talking about the sort of slowness and the methodical nature of it. But I'm reminded of a passage I read recently in a great history of New York City food and restaurants that William Grimes wrote called Appetite City. And in it, he has a statistic some huge percentage of people in early New York in the 19th century would have, for a nickel, a coffee and two slices of pie was a typical lunch. And he describes this one pie maker, when they couldn't be anything but artisanal, I mean, we're talking 1880, that delivered 30,000 pies a day to downtown Manhattan food shops and things. Like, what is it about pie?
That's amazing.
Can you imagine?
I think I read that too. And I just remember my mind being completely blown because I thought that, you know, I made a very small fraction of that number for Thanksgiving and I almost died. So right. I was doing it all by myself. But
before major refrigeration, one presumes, right. And before Crisco, or I mean, maybe use butter. But
they might have been using like suet or something. I'm just trying to imagine what fat they were using, or lard, I guess. Right. But yeah, they were a little more lax about refrigeration at that time. I guess they were just okay with it. For me, it's like everything's got to be cold, you know. Right. I'm very anal about that. I think pie, it's historical. I mean, it's been around for a really long time, and I think it is one of those things that can be made with very expensive ingredients, and it can be made with very inexpensive ingredients. It's sort of, you know, shoe fly pie is a perfect example of a recipe that was made with very humble ingredients. It's molasses, it's an egg, you know, it's some water and baking soda and, you know, spices, and that's pretty much it, you know, some butter. And so it's something that you can whip up, and it's delicious and it's satisfying, but it's humble, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that even when you're kind of elevating it and using really fine ingredients and using really, you know, methodical and practiced methods, it's still humble. I mean, mm-hmm. my pies still look handmade. You know, they don't look like these perfect pressed crusts that you know, that all look the same. They all look different.
Right.
You know, you can see my hand in all of them. And I think that there's something that appeals to people.
I think that's really interesting because I've never thought about it before. But of course, if you think of some other great food cultures with baking at their heart, like France, for instance, there you think of tarts. And tarts, you don't think of as looking handmade. In fact, a handmade tart is kind of, well, I mean, I guess there's a rustic idea or a galette or something, but you go to a French pastry shop and it's the farthest thing from looking handmade. I mean, it looks like it's perfectly made.
It's precise. A sculpture.
Yeah,
it's
they're
jewels.
Stunning.
Yeah.
But it's not a pie.
No, not at all. I mean, it really is not a pie. I mean, pies look kind of messy. They look kind of homely, you know? Right.
And that's where their beauty is.
Yeah. Though. I think there's something gorgeous. It's like joli laid. You know, there's something really beautiful about them and their kind of messed up, beat upness.
So one of the things you're known for, and if you go to the website for First Prize Pies, you'll notice, is that you start with what seem like some traditional or familiar combinations and flavors, and then you mix them up and you add your own take, or you sort of change the taste profiles. And I wonder if you could talk about both some of the combinations that you do, but also what's behind the inspiration to make a pie,
new pie. Yeah. Well, yeah, I like to put my little twists on things. I mean, some of my recipes are pretty classic, but I find it hard to resist putting either alcohol or some kind of citrus zest or both into my pies. So I find that just putting, like, you know, a couple of shots of booze in a pie really, it just gives it that little extra
two
something.
Two for the pie, one for the pie maker.
Yeah. There's always alcohol around, which is nice. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it does make things taste a little more sophisticated, I think. So, for example, my apple pie is an apple brandy pie. That's my basic apple pie. I mean, upon request, I can certainly leave the booze out, but I'd rather not.
Right.
I do an apple cranberry where I kind of, it's a riff on the idea of taking cranberry sauce and basically combining it with apple pie. So I cook dried cranberries down with Cointreau and then put some orange zest in as well and some fresh cranberries. And, you know, I think that layering flavors like that really makes a difference as well. Like the bourbon ginger pecan has three different kind of formats of ginger. So there's dry ginger, like dried ground ginger, there's fresh grated ginger, and then also crystallized ginger that I chop up. And I learned that from my mom. I mean, she in her truffles will take maybe five or six different versions of a flavor and put it in, and it gives you a really heightened representation of that flavor, a lot more nuanced, I think.
Great. What have you brought us a beautiful little pie here? What am I looking at?
That is the
creamy top.
That's the hot chocolate pie. It's like a Mexican hot chocolate idea. So it has a ginger snap crust, dark chocolate filling. It's sort of somewhere between a ganache and a custard. It's got a bit of egg in there with cayenne, ground ginger, and cinnamon. And then it's topped with a cinnamon whipped cream and some chili flakes. So it's a little bit hot and creamy and
yum. Well, I can't wait to get into it. Let's talk about the crust for a second. We just talked about some filling combinations, and this has a ginger snap
yeah.
crust. We have a question from a listener who's asking about how you do you think about the crust? I mean, sometimes crust could just be a neutral medium or at least a buttery, flaky medium.
Right.
But do you incorporate that into your flavors? What's the relationship of crust to filling in a pie?
I do think about that. I have a lot of more unusual cookie crust. So for the chocolate peanut butter pretzel pie, it's a pretzel crust,
wow.
you know, where it's just pretzels ground up with butter. There's no sugar or anything added to it. So you get a really nice salty foil for the sweet peanut butter filling.
It's too bad we don't have our nutritionist Lisa Sasson here, who was on before the holiday to talk about that pie.
Oops. Super healthy.
Well, at least it's pretzels and not potato chips,
it
for
is.
Instance.
And they're Martin's pretzels, which are wonderful. Family business.
Really great ingredients.
I use organic peanut butter, and you know, it's definitely, I think a lot about that too. And mm-hmm. I don't want to be putting junk in people. Mm-hmm. If it's going to be fattening, at least it's good fattening, you know.
There's words to live by, actually. You might have to tweet that. If it's going to be fattening, at least it's good fattening. So other crust concepts?
Well, my sort of classic crust, you know, for things like apple pies and fruit pies is sort of simple pot brisé, maybe not so simple. I kind of mess with it all the time. But it, again, is about the quality of the ingredients. So I use Plougra butter. And I think using a high butter fat European style butter and pie crust makes a huge difference, both in it doesn't shrink as much, there's a lower water content, so, and the flavor is just so much more pronounced of butter. It's such a more delicious mm-hmm. butter flavor. And I use whole milk that I sour with some apple cider vinegar instead of water. Again, it's more fat and less shrinkage, and I find that it just results in a flakier crust, and unbleached flour and all mm-hmm. of that. So, you know, that's important. Mm-hmm. And I use that for my fruit fillings and things. But then, you know, for the root beer float pie, it's vanilla wafers and ginger snap cookies mixed together for the crust. And so I do think about that. I think about what complements the filling and the topping. And, you know, pie is really a crust filling topping format. And you can play around a lot with that and flavor combinations if you just kind of think about how all of those things interact.
So we should let people know that they can order your pies. You can go to the Essex Street Market and just have a piece of pie or get a whole pie, but you can also order them online, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I really bake to order. So I do keep things in stock at Ronnie Sue's Chocolates. But if you want a specific flavor, and I have like 25 or so on my website, and I can't keep all of those in stock all the time.
Not.
And I like to keep things really fresh. So generally, what I advise is go to the website. It's firstprizepies.com, and you'll click on the shop button, and you can see everything that's available right now, and you can place your order, and I can usually turn things around in 1 or 2 days. And then you can pick up at Ronnie Sue's. I can deliver within Manhattan, or I also can ship certain flavors.
And some of your pies are also available in restaurants. And in fact, we didn't really get to the other part of your family that's in the food business. Your brother, who is a chef and also serves your pies, does he not?
He does, yeah. And that was also really integral to kind of my business taking off initially. Right when I was starting my business, Fatty Q in Brooklyn was opening. And
it always comes back to Brooklyn, doesn't it?
I know, it really does. Again, this sort of just fell into place. I went to the friends and family dinner, and I brought a shoe fly pie as a gift for the kitchen, as like a thank you. And they all, you know, ate it after service. And I got a call the next day from my brother, Corwin, who is the executive chef of all of the Fatty Crab and Fatty Q restaurants. And he was like, so we need dessert. We don't want to make it. And we think that pie really works with barbecue. What do you think? Can you do it? And it just kind of worked out. We made it happen. They're actually closed for, I think, until March for renovations. They're kind of redoing that whole space. So for now, that's on hold. But yeah, that's been the main dessert on the menu. And it's just a rotating selection of whatever I want to send them.
And because he's your brother, you've charged him twice as much, right?
Actually, I did the opposite initially, and I had to kind of, I was like, wow, I'm actually sometimes losing money. I should probably fix
big
this.
Big mistake. Well, if you have any questions, if you want pie, maybe if you have suggestions for flavors, I would tweet them to @firstprizepies. And I'm sure Allison, who is on the other end of that, would appreciate any information or any contact or interaction.
Yeah, I get a lot of emails from people all over the world. I got an email from someone recently who was telling me about a gypsy pie, which is like a regional pie, I think in Dorset, that I'd never heard of before. And it's a really simple recipe and something that's like on my list of things to test. And I'm actually in the process of working on a book. And so I'm trying to get as many new recipes as possible to try and play around with. To maybe include.
In the few minutes left, any thoughts of savory pies? I mean, when you said Dorset and I think of England, pie has a different connotation there sometimes, and it's often Sweeney Todd-esque, although hopefully not with parts of people in them. But
yeah, I'm going to skip that for now. It'd be a very special custom order. No, I actually am in the process right now of talking with the people over at Heritage Meat in the Essex Street Market about making meat pies for them to sell. So that's something that's on the horizon that's going to be happening soon.
Oh, well, you heard it here first, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we just talked about it a couple days ago. Fantastic. So yeah, that should be happening in the next couple of weeks.
Well, thank you, Allison, for joining us, and run out everybody and go eat some pie. Maybe not 30,000 pieces a day or something, or pies a day, but next week we're going to be talking about taste from a different aspect. We're inviting our associate producer, Ashley Koziak, and some of her colleagues at NYU's Food Studies program, Amy Rosenthal and Nathaniel Coburn, to talk about learning about food from an academic standpoint and what motivates that. I myself have a PhD from the department at NYU, and I can't for the life of me tell you why, except that it was a wonderful experience, and it's come in quite handy. So join us every Wednesday at 11 o'clock on Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. You can also listen to the archive and download us on iTunes. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.